stood up, shaking his head.
I can't think what good a title would be to me if it didn't come with the property.
It might help you sell more real estate, I said sweetly. I had meant it as sarcasm, but he thought I was serious and burst out laughing, clapping his hands together.
You might have something there, sis. Add a touch of class to the business.
He paused, taking a sip of tea.
You know, I've been planning to come over and surprise the old guy. I was going to bring the wife and kids and let him see how it turned out. He never thought I'd amount to much. Too bad he died not knowing.
I didn't think my father would have been as thrilled as Teddy clearly thought he'd have been. I wasn't quite sure what strip malls were, but they didn't sound too respectable. Teddy fished into his own wallet.
Look, here's my card. If you're ever in the States, come and visit. My ma would be interested to see you, I'm sure. And the kids would get a kick out of an English aunt, speaking the way you do.
Thank you. You're very kind, I said. He stood up, heading for the door. And you're sure you don't want any of this before I donate it? I asked, gesturing around the room. He was still grinning.
This old stuff? Hell no. You're welcome to the lot.
We parted company then. I watched him get into a car and drive away, wondering what kind of little boy he had been when he had lived at Langley Hall, and thinking about how glad I was that my father was dead. I didn't think he'd have been happy to see what Teddy Schultz had become. By the end of the next day, I was ready to leave. Miss Honeywell had agreed to store the desk and trunk in the attic again. I promised to come for them as soon as I had a new place of my own, and she had generously offered for her own maids to come over and clean up the lodge for the new tenant. She had even shaken my hand warmly.
I wish you nothing but the best, Joanna. I'm sure you'll make a splendid lawyer and do great credit to your family name.
I was standing outside the front door, staring for one last time around what had been my home, when a car drew up and Nigel Barton got out. You've caught me just in time, I said. I was about to leave. He looked at my two suitcases.
Then let me give you a lift to the station, or have you called for a cab?
No, I was planning to walk, so thank you, I said gratefully. I glanced back at Langley Hall as we drove away.
Your brother came to see me, he said. That was a bit of a surprise.
It was for me too, I agreed. I think he was horribly disappointed in his inheritance.
Yes, he questioned me for some time. I believe he thought you were hiding something from him, or you didn't quite know the contents of the will. When I reassured him there was nothing but a title, he went away. Not the most pleasant of individuals.
Daddy would have been horrified, I said. We pulled up in the station yard.
I'll be in touch, he said. I think the various sums of money will be released in the next week or so, and the items should go to auction soon.
Thank you. You've been very kind, I said.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure.
He paused.
Joanna. I may call you Joanna, mayn't I? I do come up to town from time to time. Maybe I could take you to a show or something.
Scarlett had said something about falling off a horse and the best thing to do being to get right back on again. But it had been such a great and damaging fall. I wasn't sure I wanted to ride any more. It's only a show, my inner voice was saying. Nothing more. Thank you, I said. I'd like that. His face lit up. But we never did go to that show, because in a little over a month, I had left for Italy.
Chapter 10. Hugo. December 1944. After Sophia had gone, Hugo sat holding the bandage over his wound for a long while, until gradually he felt the morphine starting to work. There was still some water left in the battered tin mug, and he drank it gratefully, then remembered the chestnuts she had left for him. He peeled off the prickly casings and ate their contents. They weren't as satisfying as the roasted chestnuts at home, but they were edible. The rain was starting to drip onto him, and Hugo realized he would need to concoct some kind of shelter for himself before the rain got any worse. He used the last of the bandages to hold a pad around his wound and pulled his trousers back up, in spite of Sophia's admonition. He wasn't about to be caught by Germans with his trousers down. Then he stood up, reaching for the stick that acted as his crutch. The morphine was working well, and he felt only faint stabs of pain as he moved forward cautiously. The first thing he did was relieve himself. After that, he felt well enough to fish for the packet of cigarettes and lighter in his bomber jacket. He perched on the broken pew, taking long drags and giving a sigh of contentment. He had nearly a full pack. If he rationed himself, he could make them last for several days. He smoked the cigarette right down to the butt, then stubbed it out. He now felt ready to tackle what needed to be done. He stood in the middle of the chapel, assessing the situation. There were certainly plenty of building materials. The whole roof had collapsed, but in the far corner there had been some kind of side chapel built into a nook, with the altar still standing. He hobbled around, dragging pieces of broken wood over to the corner. He placed what must have been a cupboard door on the floor, then leaned several planks against the altar front to make a teepee-like shelter. Then he brought out his parachute. He couldn't decide whether to drape it over the whole thing as a waterproof tent, or to use it as a covering around himself inside. He opted for the latter. At least under those planks of wood it wouldn't draw attention to himself, and spread it out on the floor. Then he lowered himself to the ground and eased himself in through the gap, wrapping himself in the parachute. The floor felt horribly hard, but the fine parachute silk did seem to trap his body heat. He wished he'd taken the time to put on his usual canvas flight suit. He was supposed to wear it over his clothes, but the pilots found them bulky. On missions like this, he wasn't even flying high enough or long enough to get really cold. He took out his service revolver and loaded it, retrieved the knife, and made sure they were where he could easily reach them. Then he tucked the pouch that had held his parachute and first aid kit under his head and lay back. Now there was nothing to do but wait. He must have drifted off to sleep. The morphine was giving him strange dreams. He was on a high mountain, with clouds swirling below it, and angels and devils were wrestling for his soul. The devils had swastikas tattooed onto their foreheads, and were trying to drag him down to a place below the clouds. Then one of the angels took him by the arm and lifted him up, and now he was flying. "Don't let me fall," he cried out, looking up at the angel.
"Of course they won't. You are safe with me," the angel said.
And her face transformed into that of Sophia Bartoli. Hugo opened his eyes and found he was smiling. Then his heart gave a lurch as he spotted a woman's face looking at him through a gap between his piled planks of wood. Not Sophia, a woman with light hair and a crown. He sat up, banging his head against the altar table and swearing. He peered out. While he had been sleeping, the rain had stopped, and sunlight was now streaming into the chapel. The rays of slanted winter sun were falling directly onto a fresco on the opposite wall. Parts of the fresco were pockmarked and damaged, but this part was still intact. It showed a picture of the Virgin Mary. He couldn't tell if she had been holding the child Jesus, as that part of the fresco had been blown away. Just her face smiled down at him, and he found this extremely comforting. A sign, almost, that heaven was protecting him. The thirst had returned, and his head felt woozy from the morphine. He looked down at his watch. Only 11 o'clock. He had a long day ahead of him. He eased himself out of his shelter and managed to stand up. The morphine must have been wearing off, because the pain shot through him again and he cried out. He started in fear at a loud noise nearby, but then saw that it was only a pigeon flapping away from the jagged wall above him. "Pigeons," he thought. "Future food, if I have to stay here long. But I couldn't cook it up here. Maybe Sophia could take it home, cook it, and..." "Stop," he told himself. "I can't put her and her family in danger." She'd already told him that a whole village had been executed for helping the partisans. She would undoubtedly suffer the same fate for aiding a British pilot. "I must get away from here," he decided. "Maybe hide out for a few days, just until the wound has healed and I've made a splint. Then I'll go south." He took the battered tin mug, then eased himself along the wall to the front door. He gasped. Before him, a vista stretched out in all directions, hill after hill, covered in thick forest, disappearing into blue haze, and in the distance, higher mountains, their tops already dusted with snow. No sign of a big town, but some of the hills were crowned, like the one immediately before him with the fortified village. It stood out now in clear three dimensions, highlighted after the rain, the houses clinging together as if afraid they might slip down the hillside. He stared at it with appreciation, admiring the faded ochre and green shutters of the houses, the graceful bell tower rising above the terracotta tiles of the roofs, the crumbling walls built to keep out intruders. Smoke curled up from chimneys into the still air. The hills close by were a mix of cultivation, neat lines of olives or vines cut out of thick woodland. Wild and tame, he thought. That summed it up. Then his gaze moved over to the west. Where part of the rock had been blasted away, he could see the remnants of a track snaking up the hillside to the monastery. He could pick it out through the trees to where it met a road far below in a valley. As he watched, he saw three army trucks driving northward. He picked out the swastika on one of them. There's no way I can escape at this moment, he thought. He was glad that the track had been blown away near the top. No German lorry would try to come back to this point. Thus reassured, he stepped through the doorframe and made his way carefully over the cracked and tilted stones of the forecourt. He found Sophia's rain barrel full and overflowing, and dared to take a long drink, praying the rain had not stirred up whatever might be breeding in it. Then he looked around at the piles of rubble, wondering if there might be anything that could be of use. He was clearly standing beside what used to be a kitchen. Shards of pottery lay strewn about, an occasional cup handle or curve of a basin revealing what the items had once been. But there was nothing whole and intact. In his current condition, he didn't dare to go further, to dig and potter among the ruins. But then he spotted a pillow, burned and with the stuffing spilling out of it. It was, naturally, soaking wet, but he carried it back in triumph, hoping it would dry out soon. Once back inside, he was overcome with exhaustion, and barely managed to spread out the kapok from the pillow on one of the fallen beams before feeling that he had to sit down or he would pass out. He lowered himself with much grunting and swearing back into his little shelter, lay down, and knew no more. When he opened his eyes again, it was dark, the sort of absolute darkness you find only far away from civilization. He couldn't even see his hand in front of his face. She wouldn't come now, he thought. There was no way she could find her way up through the woods in this darkness. He felt an absurd sense of disappointment. Of course she couldn't leave her family twice in one day. It would look too suspicious. Then doubts crept in. What if she had been seen? What if someone in the village had binoculars and had been spying on her? What if she had been turned over to the Germans and right now they were on their way to get him? He broke out into a cold sweat. He had to speak to himself quite sternly to get a grip on his fear. Of course nobody had seen them from the village. When they had come up to the ruins, the clouds had been hanging over the hilltops. He had only just been able to make out the village. Not the sort of day that anyone would take their binoculars and decide to observe the countryside. Unless you were a German sentry, posted as an observer on a hilltop. The fear returned. He knew that he would never feel safe for even a minute, and was overcome with empathy for the inhabitants of that village, never knowing when the Germans would arrive, claiming that they had helped a partisan, lining them all up in the village square and shooting them all. I shall start making myself a splint, he thought, but could do nothing until it was light again. He certainly wasn't going to use his precious cigarette lighter, except for emergencies. And so he lay there, listening to night noises, the creak and crack of branches in the forest below, the hoot of an owl, the distant howl of a dog. It was going to be a long night. He must have been dozing, because he awoke to see a light flickering nearby.
Signor! Ugo!
He heard the whisper and the fear in her voice.
Over here, Signora. In the corner.
He watched the light bobbing closer as he sat up and pushed one of the planks aside. She was wrapped, as before, in a big black shawl, and he could just see her eyes in the light of the candle lantern she was carrying.
Oh, you have built yourself at home,
she said, smiling at him.
How clever. When I did not see you, and you did not hear the first time I called, I was afraid that perhaps you had...
She didn't finish the sentence. She let the shawl fall over her shoulders. Oh, not quite dead yet, he said, attempting flippancy. She laughed.
That is good to hear, because I have brought you things to make you strong again.
He hauled himself out of his shelter, grunting with pain as he did so. She came over, put the lantern on a beam, and squatted down beside him.
See, I bring you food.
She opened a cloth bag she had been carrying, and brought out what looked like a towel. She unwound it to reveal a basin inside.
Soup,
she said.
I hope it is still hot. It is good, full of beans and macaroni and vegetables.
She handed it to him. The basin was still hot to touch. Well, it's very warm. You must have come quickly.
Oh, yes, I did not like to linger in the olive groves alone. You never know who might be there these days. If the partisans are meeting, they would not want to be seen by a woman. I would be in as much danger from them as from the Germans.
Oh, look, please don't come again, he said. I really don't want to put you in danger.
Don't worry, I am careful, she said. I did not light the lantern until I was well away from the village. Here, you will need this.
She handed him a spoon and watched as he ate.
It's
very good, he said. I should save some for tomorrow, unless you need your basin returned now.
It will not taste so good when it is cold, she said. Besides, I have brought you something for the morning. Not much, I'm afraid, but it will keep you going.
She reached into her bag again.
Some polenta, a little hard cheese, an onion. Polenta we still have. The Germans do not like cornmeal.
I can't thank you enough.
It is nothing.
She gave him such a sweet smile.
When the world has gone mad, we must help each other when we can. Most of my neighbors are good and share what little they have. When Benito snared a rabbit, he gave us some of it to make the good broth you are eating. And when I came home this morning, I passed Signora Gucci, and she saw the mushrooms I had found. Funghi di bosco, she exclaimed. I love funghi di bosco. If you can find some for me, I will bake bread and biscotti for your family. Here, take them now, I said, and gave her most of them. I will go out looking every day to find you more.
Sophia looked up at Hugo. He saw her eyes glowing in the light of the lantern.
She is quite rich, and she has a son who brings her things from the black market. If I can find her mushrooms, she may keep us supplied. And I have an excuse now to come up here. She is a gossip. She will tell everyone how diligently I am hunting for her.
He returned her smile.
But how did you manage to get away tonight?
Did your husband's grandmother not want to know where you were going? What time is it, anyway?
It's after 9, she said. The old lady and my son are asleep. They think I am in my room. But I climb out of the back window where I can't be seen.
How old is your son?
He's 3.
She paused.
My husband has never seen him. He was called up and sent off to Africa before Renzo was born.
And you don't know if he's still alive?
That's right.
She stared down at her hands.
I have never had confirmation that he is dead. So I have to believe that he is in a prison camp somewhere. I have to keep hoping.
He reached out and covered her hand with his, a gesture he would never have done at home. I'm so sorry. It must be awful, not knowing. But then my wife doesn't hear from me often, and knows that I fly bombing missions. She must worry, too.
You have children?
One son. I suppose he's 9 now, but I haven't seen him since he was 5. I try to picture how he looks all grown up, but I can't. All I see is a little boy dragging his teddy bear around with him everywhere. A timid little chap, running back to Nanny.
Nanny? Your grandmother lives with you?
No, his nursemaid.
A nursemaid? Then you are rich?
He hesitated.
We have a big house. Not much money, but plenty of land and servants.
You are a milord.
She was looking at him with wonder now.
My father is. I shall be, when he dies. Well, not a lord exactly, a baronet. A sir.
Sir Hugo. Imagine what they would say in the village if they knew I was speaking with a milord.
She said it with great drama, making him laugh. That all seems so irrelevant now, doesn't it? Lords and chimney sweeps fight side by side and die side by side. Nobody cares what they once were.
That is so true. You must miss your poor wife very much.
He hesitated, thinking about this. Did he miss her? I'm not sure how much. We were never very close. But I miss my former life. How easy it was, having someone to cook my meals, wash my clothes, saddle my horse for me. And I took it all for granted. But you clearly miss your husband.
Oh, yes. I miss my Guido terribly. I was only 18 when I met him. I had been raised in an orphanage in Lucca. Raised without love, you know. And when I was 18, I was sent to be a servant at a big farm. Guido was working in the fields there as a hired hand.
Jesu Maria, he was so handsome. And the way he smiled at me, I felt as if I was melting like candle wax. We fell in love instantly, and when his father died, we married, and he brought me to his house in San Salvatore. His father had some land, not much, you understand, but enough. The olives we walked through, the pasture for the goats. We had a small flock of them, and we made goat's cheese for the market. But we had only been there for a year when the war came to us. And Guido was taken away.
And you were expecting a child?
Yes. It was the worst day of my life when I watched him get into the truck with the other men and be driven off. He waved to me. And that was the last I ever saw of him.
Oh, I'm so sorry. She nodded, and he could see her fighting back tears.
Still, I must go on for the sake of my son. It is not easy. We pick the olives, then the Germans come and take most of our olive oil. We grow some vegetables, and they come and take those too.
And the goats?
They were taken long ago. I begged them to leave me one so that I could have milk for my child, who was not well at the time. But they didn't speak Italian, and I didn't speak their language. So I had to watch my goats being loaded into a truck.
She pulled the shawl more tightly around her against the cold wind that blew in through the door opening.
I should not complain. It is the same for everyone. They take what we have. Cows, chickens, even vegetables. All gone.
I heard a rooster crowing in your village, so someone must still have chickens, he said.
That is our mayor, Signor Pucci. He pretends to be friendly and helpful, and they let him keep a couple of chickens. And one of the farmers still has a few sheep. The Germans do not like the taste of lamb.
She gave him a wry smile.
And so we exist. I am luckier than some. I grow corn and vegetables. I dry the beans from the summer crop. I make cornmeal for polenta. We will not starve. And neither will you, as long as I am here.
Hugo had finished the soup. He felt its warmth spreading through his body. I can't thank you enough. He handed her back the empty bowl.
It is nothing. You see, I have brought you other things.
She reached for the bag and produced items like a conjurer.
A blanket. It will help to keep off the worst of the cold. And an old sheet. It is clean. You can tear it up to make bandages for your wound.
She held up a small bottle.
This is grappa. It will help to keep out the cold. And I found this.
She held up what looked like a spoke from the back of a kitchen chair.
This may work as a splint while your bone heals itself.
You're amazing, Hugo said. But won't these things be missed?
I'll tell you a secret.
She put her finger to her lips, even though they were alone in the darkness.
My husband's family has been in their house for many generations. The attic is full of unwanted things. When I have more time, I shall see what else I can find.
Oh, you must go now, he said. I will be content with food in my belly and a blanket. And tomorrow I may be feeling stronger.
Let us pray to Our Lady that you will. And I don't know the saint of broken legs or wounds. I must ask Father Filippo. He'll know.
Father Filippo?
Our parish priest. He's very wise. He knows everything.
Well, don't tell him about me, he said, his voice rising.
I will have to, in confession. But the seal of the confessional is sacred. He may tell no one. He has made this promise to God, so do not worry.
She patted his hand, stowed the basin in her bag, and draped the shawl around her head and shoulders again.
May la Madonna watch over you until I return. Milord Ugo.
He watched her lamplight bobbing across the darkness of the chapel. In the doorway she turned and smiled at him. He had an absurd desire to blow her a kiss. Then he heard her footsteps going down the stairs until they were lost in the silence of the night.
Chapter 11. Joanna. June 1973. It was the beginning of June when I got out of the train in Florence. Back home in England it had been dull and drizzling for days. People had muttered about how late summer was this year, and there had been news reports of early crops being flattened by hail. Here the sky was a brilliant blue, the blue that my father had painted all those years ago. The ochres and terracottas of the buildings with their bright red tiles glowed in the rich light. I stood looking around me, taking in the people, their faces alive and animated, not trudging with heads down against the wind as they did in London. There was the dome of the cathedral, taller than every other building, and beyond it the hills rose, clothed in forest. It was so lovely it almost took my breath away. I felt incredibly free, as if I was a butterfly just released from my cocoon. To her credit, Scarlett had not thought I was completely mad when I announced that I was going to Italy to find out what had happened to my father during the war. Yeah, good idea. Get right away from all the nastiness and from that bastard Adrian. Give yourself a chance to put it all behind you. She didn't say, what about your articles? Do you think your solicitor will still allow you to come back? And what about your law exam? When do you propose to sit it now? I had asked myself those questions, but had silenced the doubting voice. I had always been the good child, trying to please, to succeed, to do the right thing, and look where it had got me. Now I had a little money in my pocket, enough for a down payment on a flat, I had reminded myself, and I was going to do something quite reckless and uncharacteristic. It felt wonderful. I had met Nigel Barton again in London when he came to tell me that I was free to take the money from my father's bank accounts, and that the person who had cleaned the paintings thought they might be worth more than a cursory clean.
"I'll let you know as soon as your items go to auction," Nigel said. "And when we know more about the paintings, you can decide if you want to keep them or send them to auction as well."
"Thank you," I said. "You've been very kind."
"Only doing my job, as my father used to say."
He smiled.
"So you'll go back to work now, but I'm sure the grieving process will take you a while. It always does."
I felt tears stinging at my eyes. "I didn't think I'd grieve at all," I said. "My father was not an easy man. He was critical and he never encouraged closeness. But now I really miss him, and I wish I'd taken the trouble to get to know him better." I weighed whether to show him the letter and tell him my plans. "Actually, I've just found out that he was in Italy during the war," I said. "I always knew he'd survived a plane crash, but I didn't know where. I thought I'd go over and see the site for myself, see if the villagers remember anything about him."
"Oh, good idea. Now you have a little disposable income," he said. "Whereabouts in Italy?"
"Tuscany," I said. "The village was called San Salvatore. I'm not exactly sure where it is." He frowned.
"San Salvatore? No, that's not familiar. I've done the principal tourist sites. Siena, Cortona, Florence, of course. Do you know the area?"
"I've never been abroad before apart from a 2-day trip to Paris with the school once," I confessed. He beamed then, making him look quite attractive.
"You'll love it. And the food."
"The food is good?"
"The food is incredible. All those rich, herby sauces for the pasta. You'll put on weight, I guarantee. Although that wouldn't worry you, I'm sure. You are so slender."
Slender wasn't really the word. Skinny was more like it. I had lost weight in the past months. "I look forward to it, then," I said. "My mother was a terrific cook, but since then I don't think I've really enjoyed my food."
"And the local wines," he said. "I wish I had some holiday coming. I'd pop over and join you."
"I expect I'm only going to be a few days." I said hesitantly, because he was coming across as too eager again.
Take your time. Enjoy it, he said.
I had spent the last few weeks in London taking a crash course in Italian. Of course, I wasn't fluent yet, but I felt confident that I could get by. I had a small Italian dictionary and phrasebook in my purse, just in case, and my father's little box. I had carried that with me everywhere as a kind of talisman. It was only as I sat jolting and unable to sleep on the night train travelling across France, and then through the Alps, that doubts started to creep in again. What was I doing? What did I really hope to achieve? The woman to whom my father had written had no longer been at her last known address. That meant she had moved away, or had died. If there had been a child, and that child had been hidden away where nobody else could find him, then he too would be long dead. Even if by some miracle I located Sophia, I would only be reawakening a long-ago grief, maybe causing trouble for her if she had a husband or family. The problem was that I had to know. I was naturally curious on my own behalf, but more than that, I felt this was something I had to do for my father. I would be filling in the blank pieces of his life puzzle. Maybe I would answer the questions of why a brilliant young painter suddenly stopped painting, and why for the rest of his life he was a hollow, remote, and depressed man. By the time the train approached Florence, I had adopted a more positive outlook. I was on a quest. Whatever happened, I felt that I was doing the right thing. I had no idea how to find the village of San Salvatore. I had looked for it on a map, and couldn't locate it. It was possible it didn't still exist, of course. Places had been bombed into oblivion during the war. I knew that. But I wasn't going to give up. Before I started on the next stage of my journey, I found a bank and changed some pounds into lira. There seemed to be an awful lot of them, and I wondered how I would keep track of all those thousands. Then I treated myself to a cappuccino and a sinful pastry made with honey and almonds at a pavement cafe, before going back into the station to find out how to undertake the next stage of my journey. Even the man in the travel agency at the station had to look up the village on a map.
San Salvatore, he said. The name is familiar, but...
Then he put his finger on it.
Ah, that's why I couldn't find it. I was looking down in the Chianti region, but it's actually in the northern part of Tuscany, in the hills above Lucca. See?
I peered over his shoulder and nodded, a tiny dot amid lots of green. And how do I get there? I suppose there is no train.
There is a train for the first part of your journey, he said.
He studied the map again.
You would need to take a train to Lucca, he said, then change to the branch line that would take you up the Serchio Valley, to a town called Ponte a Moriano. But after that, perhaps a local bus into the hills, to a village called Orzala.
He broke off and gave a very Italian sort of shrug. Then he added,
It might be simpler to rent a car.
I didn't want to admit that I still didn't have a driver's license. I don't think I'd feel comfortable driving on the wrong side of the road, I said, or on mountain roads. I thanked him, went to buy my ticket, and found my way to the right platform. We left the city behind and passed through a mixture of small towns, industrial sprawl, and arable land before arriving at the old city of Lucca. Here I disembarked and had to find out which train would take me to Ponte a Moriano. Having been told which train I needed, I had to wait an hour on a hot platform. I went outside the station to look around, but all I could see were lawns leading to an impressive city wall. Nothing of the city itself except for a tantalizing glimpse of towers and red roofs beyond that wall. I was tempted to explore, but it was a long walk, and I didn't want to carry around my suitcase on such a warm day. Eventually, the train was announced. I had to fight my way aboard along with many other people. This train looked as if it could do with sprucing up. The seats were wooden, not upholstered. The windows were horribly dirty, and the carriage was crowded with what were clearly country folk. Some of the women wore shawls over their heads. The older women were all in black, their hair hidden under black scarves. One had a live chicken in a basket. Noisy children ran up and down the aisle. Babies cried. A priest in a broad black hat looked at me disapprovingly, almost as if he could read my past sins. I turned away, uncomfortable under his gaze. The route led us between cultivated fields and old farmhouses. Sometimes I got a glimpse of a wide river. As I looked ahead, I could see the first of the forested hills rising on either side of a valley. Now the track ran closer to the river, and I saw that it was fast flowing, spanned here and there by ancient bridges. We stopped at a couple of little stations that seemed to be in the middle of nowhere. There were vineyards now planted on the hillsides and olive groves. Much sooner than I had expected, we arrived at Ponte a Moriano. Only one couple beside me got off. They were met by adoring relatives with many hugs and kisses on both cheeks. The station was a simple square building, yellow with green shutters, the paint peeling and pockmarked. I came out of the station to find myself standing in an empty street with no indication where the center of the town might be. Flies buzzed. It was hot, and I was now thirsty and hungry. I went back into the station building, and in my fumbling Italian, I asked where I might find the bus to take me to San Salvatore. The man in the ticket booth let out a stream of Italian at me that was quite incomprehensible. Eventually, with gestures, I thought I understood where I would find the bus to take me into the hills. It was on the other side of the river. I picked up my suitcase and set off down a long, tree-lined street. There were houses with gardens on either side. Still, I had no idea where the center of the town might be. The street ended at a bridge over the river. I asked an old woman dressed all in black and working in her garden where I would find a bus, and she pointed across the bridge. I trudged across, too tired and grumpy to admire the view of the hills rising on either side of the valley. The other side was clearly the center of the old town. There were shops, all closed for a midday siesta, and old crumbling buildings. And in a small central square, joy of joys, two buses were parked. A man was leaning against one of them, smoking. In my best Italian, I asked where I could find a bus to San Salvatore.
Domani,
he said.
Domani è sabato.
For a moment, I didn't think I'd understood him. Tomorrow, I asked. Tomorrow and Saturday. He nodded. So I was faced with the prospect of staying the night in a place where I didn't want to be, or finding another way to the village. And if there is no bus today, I went on in my painstakingly correct Italian, how do I reach San Salvatore?
Why do you wish to go there?
He asked.
Lucca, Pisa, Florence. These are what the tourists like. Nothing of beauty in San Salvatore. No historic buildings, no castle.
I know, I said, fighting back impatience. I am visiting friends there.
Ah, friends.
He nodded as if this was approved of.
You have friends in Italy. This is good. So, you can take the bus to Orzala, and then it is maybe 5 kilometers, and perhaps someone is going that way and can drive you.
Okay, I said. And the bus to Orzala goes when?
When I start the engine,
he said, giving me a grin. Passengers arrived to join us. We drove out of the little town and the road started to climb immediately, zigzagging up the hill in a series of switchbacks. At this time of year, everything was bright green. The grass beside the road, the leaves on the grapevines and the oak trees in the forest. And dotted among the green were bright splashes of red. Poppies were everywhere, among the lines in the vineyards, between the olive trees. Amid this riot of colour were old farmhouses, either built of rough stone or faded red stucco, their shutters bright green, their roofs tiled. Occasionally I caught a glimpse of a tower, either a church belfry or a castle. We stopped in a small village, then the road climbed again until it was running along a ridge. On either side of us the land fell away into deep valleys, and then rose again to even higher peaks. The mountains seemed to go on forever, until they faded into the blue distance. We came to a halt in a village that was little more than a row of houses and a couple of farmyards. The bus driver turned to me and told me this was where I needed to get off. I found myself all alone in the street as a church bell far off tolled midday. Nobody seemed to be about apart from a black cat stretched out on the yellow gravel outside the houses. The sun was now hot, and there didn't seem to be a cafe or any shade. The bell went on tolling, and I wondered if it was someone's funeral. I stood for a while trying to decide what to do. It seemed I was destined to walk the last 5 kilometers, but I had no idea which direction to take. I could hear the sound of a radio coming from inside one of the houses, so I took a deep breath and knocked on the door. Another woman in a black dress, clearly the obligatory uniform of women over a certain age, opened the door and glared at me. "Buongiorno," I said in my best Italian. "Where is the way to San Salvatore?" She took in my foreign appearance, my jeans, the duffel bag on my shoulder. "A destra," she said. "To the right, up the hill." Then she closed the door again. "Friendly natives," I muttered. Was this what I was about to face? In which case I wasn't likely to learn much about my father. I stood looking around me. I seemed to be on top of the world with views in all directions, but there were higher hills to the north and west covered in thick forest. No sign of any village. I sighed and set off along the road, then spotted a small side road leading up the hill between vineyards before it disappeared into the forest. The hill rose steeply, and it seemed a daunting prospect. I had gone about 0.5 kilometer when I heard the sound of an approaching engine. I stopped and did what I had done only once before. I stuck my thumb out. A van approached, driving fast. When the driver saw me, he screeched to a halt. I ran up to him. "Are you going to San Salvatore?" I asked.
"I'd be wasting my time on this road if I wasn't," he said. "It doesn't go anywhere else. Jump in."
He was a portly, middle-aged man and seemed quite safe. I got in and sat with my bag on my lap because there was nowhere else to put it. The interior of the van was crowded with various sorts of tools. He was either a plumber or a handyman of some sort. He was wearing a not-too-clean overall, and he gave me a friendly grin.
"German?"
he asked, noting my fair hair and height. "English," I said.
"Ah, English."
He gave a nod of approval.
"And you speak Italian?"
"Just a little," I replied. "I hope to learn more."
"And why do you go to San Salvatore?"
he asked.
"Nothing much there. No historic buildings. No towers like San Gimignano."
"My father was there during the war," I said. "I wanted to see for myself." This made him react with surprise.
"In San Salvatore? I always thought it was the Americans who liberated this part of the country. The English were over on the coast."
"His plane crashed, I think."
"Ah."
We drove for a while in silence. The road was now little more than a dirt track. At first it climbed through thick forest, then emerged onto a ridge lined with cypress trees. The view was spectacular. Ahead of us, I could see a cluster of buildings huddled together at the top of a hill. On all sides, vineyards and olive groves fell away into small valleys, only to rise again to meet woodlands. The top of the hill opposite was thick with leafy forest, and a rocky crag rose from it, topped by an old ruin. It was the sort of scene one would have expected from the Romantic painters. All it needed was a few merry peasants coming home with rakes on their shoulders. We entered the little town and drove up a narrow street lined with old stone buildings, most of them with shutters closed against the midday sun. Down below, shops were open to the street, a butcher or delicatessen with piles of salami in the window, a shoe shop, a wine merchant with casks outside. Impossibly narrow alleys led off from that central street, some hung with laundry, others with casks of wine outside doorways. And everywhere there were bright window boxes full of geraniums. The street was made of cobblestones, and we bumped over them. Then we came to a central piazza. On one side was an imposing church built of grey stone. Facing it were what seemed to be municipal buildings with crests above their doors, and on one side was a small trattoria with tables outside. At one of these tables a group of men sat in the shade of a sycamore tree, with glasses of red wine and plates of bread and olives in front of them. My driver stopped.
"Behold," he said. "This is San Salvatore. You must ascend here. I go to the farmhouse just outside the village."
I thanked him and climbed out. The van drove away, and I stood looking around, conscious of the eyes of those men on me. There didn't seem to be anyone else to ask, so I plucked up the courage to ask them if they could tell me where there was a hotel in the village. This made them look amused.
No hotel, signorina. If you want a hotel, there is perhaps a pensione down in the valley at Borgo a Mazzano. Otherwise,
he spread his hands expressively,
there are good hotels in Lucca.
I fought back tiredness and frustration. I had not really slept on the train all night. Now I was really hot and hungry. Is there nobody who rents rooms to visitors in this town? I asked. They looked at each other, muttering and conferring. Then one of them said,
Paola, she fitted out that old animal barn to let the visitors, didn't she? Ah, Paola, yes, of course.
They nodded to each other. Then one addressed me.
You should go to Signora Rossini. She may have a room for you.
Thank you, I said, although the mention of her old animal barn did not sound too inviting. And how do I find this Signora Rossini? One of the men stood up. For a moment I thought he was going to escort me, maybe offer to carry my bag, which now seemed to weigh a ton. Instead he came around to me, then pointed.
See that archway? Go through the tunnel, then keep straight ahead. You understand? Always straight. And after the last houses of the village, it is the first place you will come to on the left.
I thanked them again and set off with trepidation. I'll stay tonight, I thought, and then maybe take the bus back to the valley tomorrow and stay at a proper pensione there. Chapter 12. Joanna. June 1973. On the side of the piazza, a narrow alley dipped down between a greengrocer's with a wonderful display of fruit and vegetables outside and what looked like a wine shop on the other side. Then it entered a tunnel. I hesitated, wondering if this was some kind of local joke and God knows what I'd find at the other end of that tunnel, or even if it actually led anywhere. Was it a route to a dungeon? A cellar? But I could still feel their eyes on me, and I was not going to give them the satisfaction of seeing my fear. I stepped forward bravely. The floor was made of large cobblestones, the walls hewn out of the stone of the hillside. And after the tunnel turned a corner, I saw that one side had openings to the view, while the other had what looked like wine cellars. I came through the tunnel without incident, and followed the path that dipped steeply into the valley. The village came to an abrupt halt after only a couple of rows of houses, and I took the track that led down the hill. It consisted of two rows of rutted dirt made by the wheels of successive carts and tractors. Between the dirt rows, poppies poked their heads above the grass. After the houses came to an end, I walked between leafy vines on one side, and on the other, kitchen gardens with runner beans covered in their red flowers climbing on bean poles above tomatoes and other vegetables I didn't recognize. I went away down the hill, and there on the left ahead of me was one of the old farmhouses I had admired on my journey here. It was built of faded pink stone, its terracotta roof glowing a rich, warm red against a startlingly blue sky. Over its doorway, an old and gnarled grapevine created a shady porch, and beside it was a huge clay jar with rosemary spilling over the top. The front door was open. I went up to it and looked for a bell. I knocked tentatively but got no response. Hello? Buongiorno? I called. No answer. From the back of the house I could hear women's voices. I advanced slowly along the tiled passage, which opened up onto a big, sunny kitchen from which wonderful smells were emanating, baking bread and herbs that I couldn't quite identify. A row of copper pots hung on hooks. Beside them were braids of garlic and drying herbs. In the center was a scrubbed wooden table on which various vegetables and herbs had been chopped, and on the right-hand wall was an enormous and ancient open brick oven that could have baked a dozen loaves at once. And at the more modern gas stove beside it, a woman was standing with her back to me. My first glimpse of her made me gasp and stand rooted to the spot. It felt as if I had been transported back in time. This was my mother, the same stout build, the same hair twisted up into a bun, stirring something magical on the stove as I came home from school. Any minute now she'd turn to see me, give me a big smile, and open her arms to embrace me. Instead, a dog rose up from under the pine table and came toward me, growling. The woman turned and uttered a little cry of alarm at being startled.
"Quiet, Bruno," the woman said. "Lie down."
The dog obeyed, still eyeing me suspiciously. "Scusi, signora," I said quickly. "I knocked, but you didn't hear." Actually, I think I said that I struck the door, not having the word for to knock in my scant vocabulary.
"No matter," she said. "You are here now. How can I help you?"
"I need a room for the night," I said. "The men told me you had a place." I had practiced these phrases on the walk down, and they came out quite smoothly. She nodded, beaming now.
"Yes, of course. My little house in the garden. Once it was for animals. Now it is for people. Good, eh?"
I returned her smile. It was difficult to tell how old she was. Probably in her 40s. But her face was remarkably unlined, and her hair only showed the faintest streaks of grey. She was wearing a large blue and yellow apron over a white blouse, with the sleeves rolled up above the elbows. She wiped her hands on the apron and came toward me.
"I am Paola Rossini," she said. "Welcome."
I shook the outstretched hand. "Pleased to meet you, Signora Rossini. I am Joanna Langley," I said.
"From England?"
"Yes." She nodded approval.
"You look like an English girl, always tall and elegant. You are a student of Italian?"
"No, I'm here on a visit. I'm looking into places my father visited when he was in Italy."
"Really? And he came to San Salvatore once?"
"I think so," I said, not wanting to broach this matter now. At that moment there was a loud and piercing cry, and I remembered that we were not alone in the room. There had been a conversation going on as I walked down the hall. On a chair in the corner, a young woman sat. Her dark hair spilled over her shoulders, and she was watching me with curiosity. On her lap was a tiny new baby.
"My daughter, Angelina,"
Signora Rossini said proudly.
"And now my granddaughter, Marcella. She is just 3 weeks old. She was born early, and for a while we were worried we might lose her. But with good care and her mother's good milk, she is now doing well, eh, Angelina?"
The girl in the corner nodded, smiling shyly at me.
"Angelina's husband is a steward on a ship,"
Signora Rossini said.
"He is away at sea and has not seen his baby daughter yet. So she comes to her old mother and knows she will be well taken care of."
I couldn't take my eyes off that tiny, perfect human being, nor could I stop my brain from going to places I did not want it to visit. 3 months from now. "Stop," I commanded myself. "My congratulations on your daughter," I said, this being one of the phrases we had learned in the Italian course. Angelina beamed. "You are married?" she asked. "You have children?" I tried to keep on smiling. "Not yet," I said. "I am studying to be a lawyer."
"Oh, studying to be a lawyer?"
They looked at each other and nodded, impressed. Paola sniffed and realized she had left what she had been cooking on the stove.
"Un momento,"
she said, and rushed back to it, giving it a hearty stir. "What are you cooking?" I asked. "It smells wonderful." She turned back to me, shrugging modestly.
"It is nothing special. Just a simple lunch that we Tuscans like to eat. We call it pappa al pomodoro. You are welcome to join us. There is plenty."
"I would love to, if you are sure it's all right."
"Of course."
She turned back to her daughter.
"Put the baby down for her sleep, Angelina, and give this another stir while I show the young English lady to her room. I am sure she would like to wash before her meal."
Angelina got up and placed the tiny bundle in a cradle by the wall. The baby let out a complaining wail.
"Let her cry," Paola said. "It is good for the lungs."
She turned back to me.
"Come, I will show you."
I picked up the bag I had put down on the floor and followed her out of the back door. Bruno the dog trotted beside me, having decided if his mistress liked me, then I must be all right. A flagstone path led down the hill through a garden that was a riot of flowers and vegetables. Roses grew between bean poles and tomatoes. There were bushes of lavender and rosemary that smelled heavenly as I brushed against them. Amid the plants were various ancient fruit trees, cherries and apricots looking almost ready to pick, and apples still small green buds. The path ended in an old stone outbuilding with bars at the window. Not exactly prepossessing. Paola went around to the side, took a large key, and opened the door. "Pass, please," she said, standing back for me to go in first. The room was simple in the extreme. An iron bedstead, a white chest of drawers, a row of hooks on the wall for clothes, and a little table under the window. The floor was made of the same red tiles as the kitchen and passage. There were fresh white net curtains at the window, and the bed was made up with white linens topped with a homemade quilt.
"Va bene?" she asked. "It's all right?"
"Sì," I nodded enthusiastically. "And to wash?"
"Ah,"
she said, and opened an ancient door into a tiny bathroom.
"You have your own water. It's from the well outside, so it's not a good idea to drink this. But there is a heater for the shower. See, it turns on like this. One must make sure the handle is lifted so."
And she demonstrated.
"Be careful. It can make the water very hot."
I noted the rather alarming-looking contraption on the wall and decided to heed the warning. The bathroom had a sink, a toilet, and a very small shower, but again it was spotlessly clean. If cows had once been housed here, there was no lingering odour. In fact, the bathroom window was open and the scent of honeysuckle wafted in from the ancient wall outside. I felt instantly that this was a place where I could feel at home. "Thank you. It's good," I said. "How much money will it cost?" She named a price. I did a rapid calculation from thousands of lira into pounds and pence. It was very reasonable.
"And you will eat breakfast with us in the big house," she said. "Also, if you want to have an evening meal with us, then it will just be a little more. You tell me in the morning, and I will make something special for our dinner."
"Thank you. I would certainly like to join you for dinner if that is all right." Suddenly, I felt rather overwhelmed, as if this kindness was all too much after several months of feeling so alone.
"So, I will leave you to settle in," she said, "and I will prepare the meal. Come up when you are ready."
She left the door open, letting in a scented breeze. I was tempted to try out the scary-looking shower after my night on the train, but I didn't want to keep Paola waiting too long. I unpacked a few items, washed my face and hands, put on a fresh blouse, and brushed my hair. Then I closed the door and went back up the path. The table was now laid with brightly painted ceramic dishes and bowls. In the middle was a big platter with tomatoes, a slab of white cheese, a couple of sticks of salami, a bowl of olives, and a big loaf of crusty bread. Paola motioned for me to sit, then served me a bowl of the soup. It was almost too thick to be called a soup, and it smelled of garlic and herbs that I didn't recognize. I took a tentative sip and felt the explosion of taste in my mouth. How could anyone take simple tomatoes and onions and make them taste like this? "It is delicious," I said, hoping that delizioso was a word. "Very good." Paola hovered behind me, then pulled out a chair at the head of the table. Angelina came to join us. She had picked up the baby again, and to my shock she opened her blouse and put the baby to a large round breast before picking up her own spoon.
"So everybody gets to eat,"
Paola said with satisfaction. "How do you make this soup?" I asked. She laughed.
"So simple. It is what we call part of our cucina povera, simple food for the peasants. And a good way to use up yesterday's stale bread. It is simply stale bread soaked in broth, and then we cook the garlic, tomatoes, some carrot, and celery, and add these to it, then serve with olive oil. That's all."
I ate until I had scraped my bowl clean with today's still warm bread. Paola picked up a jug and asked if she could pour into my glass. I nodded agreement and was startled to find it was red wine she was pouring, not water as I had expected. Not too much wine.